This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Sorry, I'm practicing my Gregorian chants. Hi, everyone. I'm Greg Phillips, appropriately enough. With me is my hard-traveling fanboy companion, Nick Duke. We are the hard-traveling fanboys. We are coming to you via tape delay from the beautiful city, the serene city, our homeland of Vancouver, British Columbia, even, Canada, in Hoholoon Plaza, in the beautiful and luxurious L-shaped studios. And we're here to bring you a very unique edition of Off the Page. Nick, how have you been these last undisclosed amount of days since we recorded last week?
I've been good. I've been good. How about yourself?
I've been up, I've been down. I've been all around, Nick. I've been up and down. I've been great. I've been bad. I've been good. I've been terrible. I've been everything in between. It's been a hell of a week, Nick.
You should probably seek a mental health professional if you're experiencing mood swings that severe.
I probably should. It could also be a side effect of all the Blue Chew I've been consuming. But,
Now, wait a minute. I have it on good authority that back-to-back travel days for work have left you soft.
That's true. So perhaps the Blue Chew that I got was a bad batch. I did buy it on the black market. I did not have access to the promo code.
So is it Black Chew in that case?
I don't know. That's a question I'd never thought to ponder. Are there different colors of Chew that are equivalent to like Superman's different kinds of kryptonite, you know, that have different varying effects?
Yeah, the red Chew just makes you angry.
Angry all the time, yes.
Yeah.
The gold Chew, I believe, actually causes it to go inside you for a while.
Oh, God.
I mean, there's all kinds of...
Well, if you walk outside in the cold, that'll do that anyway, right?
Oh, yeah, we've had a little bit of a cold snap in our true home.
I don't want to hear anything about that. I don't even want to...
Oh, no, I love
it. I will not
it.
Even acknowledge that.
I acknowledge
that.
It. I embrace it. I want more of it, Nick. I want it to envelop me in its dead cold arms and embrace me. Until I pass away from pneumonia. Very good times around here, Nick. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. I'm doing okay, and the studio looks to be in pristine shape since we last left it. So our crack staff here is doing a good job. What are we here to talk about today, one might ask? We went on to the wonderful DC Universe application. I on my Roku television, Nick on his whatever he watches things on, and we decided to pull up a movie that we've never watched before. You know, Off the Page, we like to talk about things outside of the world of comics that relate to comics, properties that are inspired by the comics. And in this case, we went back and watched the original Wonder Woman movie. That's right. There was a Wonder Woman made for television, granted, motion picture before the big, successful blockbuster movie that we all know and love. And even before the Linda Carter television show that became so iconic, this was a 1974 project that was made for television and was originally intended to launch a series. It premiered on ABC on March 12, 1974. It was supposed to be a pilot for a series that would eventually become the series that we all know, but that was retooled from what this was. It was, as we'll talk about, based on a rather unique time in Wonder Woman's history in the comics. It was trying to be very of its time. And it stars not Linda Carter, but Kathy Lee Crosby. And it's just called Wonder Woman. Written by John D.F. Black, directed by Vincent McEvity. I suppose that's how you pronounce his name. And not exactly a murderer's row of cast members here, except for one, which we will hold off comment on for now. But Nick, let's talk a little bit about this project. State of comic books on television, and in particular DC Comics on television, was not terribly strong in 1974. If we go back in time, the 1950s gave us the George Reeves Superman, which is iconic and still survives to this day. And then the 60s, after a lull period, gave us, of course, the Adam West and Burt Ward Batman series, which carved out a spot in pop culture. But around that same time, DC actually, or not DC, but Warner Brothers actually created another pilot clip. It was like a 5-minute pilot clip that was designed to test the waters for a Wonder Woman TV show. And it was called Who's Afraid of Diana Prince? And I have not actually seen this, Nick, but I understand that you have.
No.
Oh, but you've seen stills or something from it, because you told me about it. I didn't even know it existed until about a year or two.
No, I just know that it existed. I have not seen anything of it.
And this was apparently so far removed from the very idea of Wonder Woman that it never saw the light of day. So time passes. The Batman show is long off the air at this point by 1974. And DC Comics' primary exposure on television is through animation, through occasional Batman specials and cartoons, Superman cartoons, Justice League cartoons, things like that, Super Friends. And then along comes this television movie. They want to make Wonder Woman a star. They want to bring Wonder Woman to the forefront for the first time in her character's history in live action. And to do this, they go with a star, a relatively unknown star, named Kathy Lee Crosby. And I'm looking, you know, I wasn't of the era, so I don't know how famous she was back then. But it looks like she was in a few TV shows and a couple of TV movies at this point. But she was not a household name, I don't believe, at the same level that you would expect of one of the other individuals that we'll talk about that was in this episode. And the era of the comics that they're basing this on is one that, Nick, I think I'm safe to say that you haven't read this era of the comics. I haven't read this era of the comics. It's known as the I Ching period of Wonder Woman comics, when Diana had lost her powers and learned Kung Fu and become a government agent, a secret spy that would go around and do spy missions and have Kung Fu battles and stuff like that. So a little bit different from the Diana that we have grown to know in our more modern exposure to the DC universe. Yes, Nick?
Yeah, a little bit different, as you said. This was an era where they had decided to kind of shake things up a bit. Wonder Woman was being portrayed as more of an espionage type book. She was running around in a jumpsuit. I'm not even sure if she had powers at this point in the comics. So, I don't really remember all the specifics, but basically Wonder Woman in name only. Any of the trappings that you would associate with Wonder Woman when you think of the character in your head had been dispensed with. And so this is, as you said, it's certainly an interesting time to take on a Wonder Woman show and have it attempt to reflect the comics. And you know, I don't know if this necessarily reflects the comics at the time, again, because I haven't read them, but this is certainly a unique beast, as we'll discuss.
Yes. One of the things that I mentioned from the jump is that this is trying to be very much of its time. It's trying to be modern, and in part of being modern is being modern for 1974. So this movie yes. is distinctly 1974 in look,
yes.
in feel, in sound. Everything is early, mid-70s. And that's for both good and for bad. It obviously dates it. It obviously ages it in terms of the fashion, the jobs of everybody, the way everything looks, the soundtrack. That's the first thing that I want to talk about here, Nick. As soon as I started playing this movie, I thought this may not be as bad as I thought it was going to be because the music is freaking awesome. It's like it sounds like you're turning on like Dolomite or Shaft or or any of those types of movies from that era, the exploitation movies that sort of defined the mid 70s. It's got this kind of thumping bass drum that's going on in the background. It almost seems, honestly, Nick, the way this movie starts, it almost starts like a James Bond movie from the era, doesn't it?
A little bit like a yeah, because Roger Moore would have been in full swing by 74, right? Yep, I'm trying to remember correct. The chronology of correct, things. Yep. But yes, very much like a more comedic, cheesier, over-the-top Bond movie. Not like an early Bond movie in the vein of Dr. No or a modern-day Craig movie, but certainly something that seems to be – at least, God, I hope it was attempting to be self-aware.
You start the movie out with these this footage of these military police around the yeah. world, and they're in all these different cities. You're seeing little title cards flash up on the screen: Istanbul, London, Paris, Toronto, all over the world, and they're all pulling out of these secret compartments these two books, and both of the books are labeled, I can't remember exactly what they're labeled, Nick, Super Secrets or something like that,
Top Secret, I don't top remember secret. Something like that,
and they're both just normal books that just have those along the spine of the book. And that in and of itself got this off to a pretty hilarious start while you've got this thumping, you know, Isaac Hayes sounding music going on in the background. A little bit of that boom, 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 boom. Really good stuff there. And then we get a flashback sequence that is, and you know, it's a flashback sequence because it's got that
it's got that wavy dreamlike effect, dreamlike
hazy effect that we would see years later in Wayne's World, and it shows Diana's origin, how she's on Paradise Island in the middle of nowhere, basically in the middle of the ocean, and her mother Hippolyta is sending her off to Man's World on a mission to spread peace and spread her knowledge and will and goodwill and all this other stuff, and while she's there on the island, one of her sisters is jealous of her and wants to follow her to Man's World, and then the other sister there on the island is terrified of Man's World and can't think of any place better than Paradise Island. And alas, the flashback sequence ends as, and to this point, this is a pretty faithful origin for Diana. Obviously, you're missing Steve Trevor. At this point, you're missing the rescue from the island. You're missing the she has to return into Man's World and all that. But it does show us that Themyscira exists. It shows us that Hippolyta exists, that Wonder Woman lived on this island for some period of time and went through trials and tribulations and earned her keep among her Amazonian sisters. So that was kind of cool, Nick. I was not expecting that. I was thinking this was going to go completely into the espionage format and forego any tie to the Amazonian myth, but they actually embraced it a little bit here.
A little bit, because then they jump straight to, from there right into the espionage stuff. So we get the backstory, but we don't really see like how she ingratiated herself to Man's World. We don't really see how she came to have her current status quo. I mean, really, for all this stuff that you would think would be introducing the character to a whole new audience, not much in the way of setup. Just, hey, here's who she is, and we jump straight to her working as a secretary.
Yes, she works as a secretary, where I'm not entirely sure, Nick, does everybody know that she's Wonder Woman? Or
I think just Trevor.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I don't know. Maybe you're right. But she works at a government agency. She works for the U.S. Intelligence Agency, Nick, as you know.
Which doesn't exist, yes.
But it's a highly secretive intelligence
fictional
agency. And she works as the secretary for Steve Trevor. Now.
That's right. Steve Trevor.
We have to talk about Steve Trevor, Nick. We have to talk about him. There's just no way around it. Steve Trevor is played by a gentleman named Kaz Garris.
That's right, Kaz Garrett.
Kaz Garris. An English-speaking Lithuanian-born actor best known for his starring role in the TV series Strange Report and for his numerous portrayals of sheriffs in low-budget thrillers. So,
no-nonsense sheriffs, I'm sure.
God, no nonsense to be had here, Nick. Even if there is nonsense, he's not going to have it.
Not a moment of levity with this Steve Trevor.
Kaz Garris, God bless him with his amazing name, is just an atrocious actor. There's just no other way of putting it here. He plays Mr. Steve Trevor, and this version of Steve Trevor, Nick, is...
He's a pencil pusher. Go ahead and say it.
He's a pencil pusher. He works in his cushy government office. He keeps files on hand. He delivers everything that he says in a monotone, disinterested voice. He appears to be incapable of moving his facial muscles to resemble anything like a smile, a frown.
No, it's always just narrowed eyes.
Narrowed eyes and a straight face. And his delivery of lines, my gosh, it's truly inspirational at times. Steve Trevor will say things like, "Diana, aren't you worried? Aren't you frightened of going to this dentist?" And then she'll deliver.
"Which dentist do you think you'll go to, Diana?"
"Ah, I thought for sure you would choose London." Later on in the film, he gets a giant box from the villain, and the box instructs him to open the box and to do it alone. So he takes his little crowbar, and he's not sure what's in this box. He's not sure if this is going to be a...
Well, no, first he has a long conversation with one of his flunkies about, you know, what might be in the box and how they had detected a heartbeat but nothing else. So there could be an assassin in there. No noises have come from the box. And he's like – and then finally he says, "Well, the instructions were for me to open it alone, so you'll have to clear off."
Yeah, I'll have to – I have no choice but to obey his commands. So the flunky runs off, and Mr. Trevor here. Now keep in mind the classic saying from Jim Cornette that anything that comes out of a box is gonna get over, motherfucker. So,
well, I suppose that's true.
Trevor takes his crowbar, Nick, and would you say that this got over? I couldn't tell.
We should probably save this for if we're going to go through the plot.
I just wanted to say that he finds something shocking in the box, but you wouldn't know it from his reaction. He reacts to it like a gentle wind just blew in through the door, and he's just mildly inconvenienced. What is this?
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Steve Trevor is almost like Dave Chappelle's news anchor at times. I understand.
My God.
I understand that Diana has gone to London. Nope, she's in Paris now. We're looking for one Abner Smith.
Oh, God. I'm reminded of a joke that I won't repeat from that anchor.
Please don't.
Do you remember the line, Greg? Do you remember the line when they're doing the it's the reparation sketch, and the field reporter says, and shockingly, the crime rate has dropped to below 5%. Do you remember what he says after that?
I don't, and we'll talk about it off the air. Or you can just send me a link. I don't remember the line.
You're worried I'm going to say it. I'm not going to say it.
What I'm not worried about is Steve Trevor's emotionless reactions to everything. So Steve Trevor is just a complete bore here. Anyway, there's this guy that walks into the there's this group of secret U.S. intelligence agency officers who are waiting to get into Steve Trevor's office to meet with him, even though Steve Trevor has had nobody in his office except Diana for quite some time now. And so Diana's out there, and you know her one of these officers whose name is God. What was his name?
I don't know.
Bob. It was Bob, wasn't it?
Bob. Let's go with Bob.
So Bob, the U.S. Bob intelligence or Bill or Chief agency, or... he goes over and he gives her this single flower that's in a some kind of a thing, and he puts it down there, and he's like, "What do you say, Diana? You want to go out later?" And she's like, and he's like, "Just think about it. Just think about it, okay?" And he goes into Steve. I don't know why he sounds like Joe Pesci. Just think about it, okay? Yeah. He goes into Steve Trevor's office. And anyway. This accountant like man and Steve Trevor are really seemingly the two highest ranking U.S. intelligence agency officers. Would you agree?
I don't have any clue. There were a bunch of them around. I mean, how do we know if that this guy's important?
Well, you
I
see
don't know.
This guy later on in the movie in the van with Steve Trevor when they're trying to figure out why their burrow tracking technology has failed them.
I don't know. Anyway.
So Diana Prince, Wonder Woman, is your lead character here. And she's portrayed by, as we mentioned, Miss Kathy Lee Crosby. And this is, in some ways, a vastly different Diana and in some ways familiar. And you might ask yourself, Nick, how is she familiar to the Diana that we know? In what way is she familiar to the Diana we know? I would argue she is familiar to the Diana we know in that she is supremely confident in herself. She is supremely wise beyond her years. She has a firm grasp on whatever situation that she's in. She knows how to talk to people. She knows how to disarm people with her kindness, with her openness. She knows how to carry on a pretty compelling conversation. And she even has some elements, I think, because of the espionage aspect there. I thought there were some Catwoman elements in here, and the way that she has her verbal repartee with some of the villains in this one. Kathy Lee Crosby is not sort of what you would expect for a Wonder Woman. She's blonde, first of all, which is totally different from Diana and any of the looks that she's had. She's much more like some of the female action stars of that era in terms of how she is presented and how she carries herself. And yet, there were times in this movie where I thought, you know what, that's kind of a good take on Diana in terms of her personality. What did you take on this? Because I know that it's not the traditional Diana. She's certainly not Gal Gadot or Linda Carter in terms of her presentation. But I thought the character that's presented here, this Diana Prince, in and of herself, is a pretty interesting character.
She's okay. I mean, it would have been nice to, again, have known more about kind of her early days of like interacting with man and stuff, because we don't really – I mean, when we see the flashback, it's just like, hey, well, I'm going to go help man's world. How did she settle on this way to help man's world? How did she settle on, you know, this particular path or whatever? As far as the character, you know, the performance goes, Kathy Lee Crosby is – she's good in moments. Then there are moments where she's kind of wooden because, you know, acting was not her first career. I believe she was a tennis player originally by trade. So, you know, there are moments where the acting isn't as strong. But I think that's kind of – par for the course for this movie. Really, there's only one good performance, what I would say is a really good performance anyway, across the board in this movie. And that's our lead villain, as we'll discuss here in a little bit. But I would give her, you know, I would say okay. I would give her a slight thumbs up, I suppose. Not near as much of a thumbs up as you gave her, as you have turned into a Kathy Lee Crosby truther now.
Yes, I give her a pretty resounding thumbs up, actually. And the reason for that is, yes, I agree with you that there are moments when her acting is wooden. Sometimes it's because of the limitations of the material, and perhaps because she's trying to play off of Steve Trevor. But I think that for the most part, I think she brings a little. Maybe it's not even so much her acting, but this version of the character is smart. It's written smart. And I think she plays Diana really smart at times, even smarter than a lot of our modern superheroes in some ways, because it's not easy to trick her. Like it's she doesn't fall into stupid, idiotic traps very often. And only once does she fall into a trap in the movie, and she really doesn't have much trouble escaping that trap. Which you could say, okay, maybe she's overpowered or whatever, but we don't really see her use power as much in this movie. It's really just her wits and her guile and figuring out how to do it. She's a very, very strong character, to the point that the men around her are intimidated by her. Or if they're not, they should be because they get their asses kicked. So I think she's good. I think she does really good in the action scenes, as limited as they are here. There's not many of them.
I was about to say, what action scenes?
You know,
catching a javelin is about
catching a javelin. Having a little stick fight with her old Angela.
Stick fight.
Angela. Yes. She gets to knock out the two goons and she's knock out George like three times in the movie. I think
I was about to say we're burying the lead here a bit because we haven't talked about George at all.
George.
Oh, George.
Andrew Prine is the actor's name, and he portrays George Calvin. This is the description of him. I am not describing him as this because I don't agree with this description. A handsome and yet intimidating figure that works for the primary villain, Mr. Abner Smith. So would you describe George Calvin as a handsome figure, Nick?
You know, it was the style at the time, the 1970s with the big hair and all that stuff. Maybe, I don't know. He looks a little bit like 80s James Spader.
You
I
know
would
who
say.
He reminded me of, Nick?
Who's that?
Ted Bundy.
Why would you say such a thing?
I'm saying the man, okay, he has the same kind of hairstyle as Ted Bundy had during some of his killings, which may have been the style at the time, granted. He has the same wild, insane eyes, and
for the record, Ted Bundy was considered to be an attractive man by many.
Yes, he was. Supposedly. However, he also has the crazy eyes.
Are you denying this?
No, I know he was described as that. I'm questioning the description is what I'm questioning. I don't know that Ted Bundy was attractive just because people tell me that he was attractive. Your thoughts, Nick?
I'm not going to sit here and stump for the attractiveness of Ted Bundy.
There's a sentence, folks, that you can put on our tombstones when this show wraps up eventually. You can say, quote, "I'm not going to stump for the attractiveness of Ted Bundy. I'm not. Nick Duke, 2019.
That's what I said. That's what I said.
So, but no, he's got the wild eyes. He's just one of the creepiest human beings who has ever existed. And this guy is...
You know, at least I will give him this. Unlike a lot of characters in this movie, at least he had a personality.
Oh, he does. He does have a personality. He's not Steve Trevor, but he's...
He's no Steve Trevor.
But his personality is that of a complete shitheel, as Arne Anderson might say.
Have we talked about what the plot of this movie even is?
Okay, so these top secret books that we mentioned at the beginning... They have been stolen by a mysterious figure.
And you need all five books to make any of them make sense somehow. Why? I don't know. But that's
and in these books are contained the identities and apparently every identifying bit of information of all of the U.S. intelligence agency operatives all over the world who are undercover.
Now, you may be asking yourself, this sounds familiar. Was this the plot to another movie that I may have seen before? Yes, this is the exact plot of the first Mission Impossible film.
So, that first Mission Impossible film clearly took its inspiration from the 1974 made-for-television Wonder Woman film, right, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely, in terms of both story and in terms of not being that good.
Damn, shots fired here. Shots fired!
Actually, I'd probably rather watch this than the first Mission Impossible again.
Hey, this has got some good stuff in it, man. It's got Kathy Lee Crosby.
And it's shorter than the damn first Mission Impossible movie.
It's got Kathy Lee Crosby. It's got got Abner Smith. Anyway, so
And it doesn't try to pass off Mr. 5'3 as an action star.
Get the hell out of here. Tom Cruise is the greatest action star of our generation, and you know it.
No, I don't know it.
It's the truth. Whether you know it
Liam Neeson would like a word, sir.
Liam Neeson's amazing. Liam Neeson's fantastic. However, Liam Neeson has not had the breadth of
now let me tell you something.
He's
right now.
He's had the length.
I would not be challenging Mr. Neeson's breadth or length if
he's
I were
had
you,
the
sir.
Length. No
you
question.
Better watch out. The baby's arm will be coming for you.
So anyway, they've determined that one of three nefarious individuals have taken these books. One of them is apparently a golfer. The other one is just some guy. And then the third guy is a mysterious man in a limousine who's never been photographed before. Who is it? Who do you think the bad guy is going to turn out to be here, Nick, in this movie?
I don't know.
Is it the guy on the golf course? Is it the other dude running around outside? Or is it the guy with the cane and the hand is all you can see hanging out the long white limousine?
Yep.
Sure enough, through her intuition, Wonder Woman instinctively knows that it's the mysterious guy with the hand hanging out of the limousine. One Abner Smith, who has never been photographed. So Wonder Woman flies off to Paris to track down Abner Smith and figure out where he's holding these books that are of such value. Meanwhile, Abner Smith, with his employees George and George's two hench people, whose names I could not tell you if you held a gun to my head.
Let's just refer to them as the androgynous twins.
The androgynous twins. And they are doing his bidding. And meanwhile, Abner asks for a ransom of several million dollars from.
But let us reiterate here. This man's name is Abner Smith.
This will come into play in just a little bit.
Yes, it will.
They ask of the U.S. Intelligence Agency several million dollars in unmarked bills. And in exchange, they'll give them back the books. Seems fair. Well, Wonder Woman doesn't like this deal. She wants to track down the books. And in the process, both George and Abner become fascinated with Diana.
$15 million. I mean, it really does read like a Dr. Evil plot, does it not? Like I know $15 million was a lot of money.
Yeah,
but
it was a lot of money in 74.
To a U.S. government, though, like, realistically, it could have been come up with in minutes, you know? It really does feel like Dr. Evil asking for $1 million.
We're going to send a burrow in a box. You're going to put the money in two burlap bags, place them on top of the burrow, and fly the burrow to us.
No, smack the burrow on the ass and tell it to
come to us in Spanish.
Yeah, yep.
Then we're going to fly the burrow and five identical burrows.
Your Dr. Evil started to turn into a little bit of a Mason Verger there near the end.
We're going to get burrows, and then we're going to get Joe Burrows.
Oh, God. Let's not go there.
Anyway, so the long story short here, they have to try to get the books. Meanwhile, Abner is trying to get his money, and they're going along with this on the surface anyway. But the way that Abner tries to get his money, as we've been alluding to, is quite bizarre. You see, a mysterious box arrives, as we've mentioned, and we
look. A giant wooden box. A giant wooden box.
And remember, as Nick talked about earlier, the agency officers have examined the box thoroughly, and they don't know what's in there. They just know that they heard some kind of a heartbeat, or something like a heartbeat. So what could be inside this box, Nick?
Any number of things. An assassin, as they say. Lots of things could be inside the box.
Could be a ticking bomb.
The box has made no noise. No noise whatsoever. So you would think the odds of a living creature being in there would be very small, right?
Well, you'd think that, but not quite as small as you might think, because...
And of course, so Steve Trevor makes his funky leave the room, gets his handy crowbar out, and opens it up.
And what does he find in there? But a donkey. A living, breathing...
Not referred to as a donkey for the rest of this film, by the way.
It is a burrow. And this burrow, or donkey, or jackass, if you will, hero, jackass... sits there silently as Steve Trevor reacts to it by staring
his eye. Yes. And then it gives out gives off a loud hee-haw. So it hasn't made a sound the entire time it was being shipped from, because remember, they're in England. So, like, this thing has to be sent across the ocean. Presumably, you would have to do that in those days, either by plane or by boat. This thing has been inside the box for at least, I'm going to say 12 hours. hasn't made a sound, hasn't shat anywhere, hasn't pissed anywhere, but as soon as he opens the box, the donkey just stands there and goes,
he's very well trained. Yes. Abner Smith trains and cares for, as we find out later in the film, he cares for these burros.
Now why does Abner Smith send a burro? Well, naturally, he's attached two saddlebags to the burro, and Steve Trevor's instructions are to take the burro to the specific town in the American Southwest, put the money in the saddlebags, and slap the burro on the ass, and it will know automatically to go to the evil lair, the hidden base.
No, slap the burro on the ass and repeat one phrase in Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
And that the burro will then know exactly how to get to the evil lair and bring the money. And and so all of the agents that are they put secret tracking level layers on this burrow. They coat it with an ultraviolet light that can be picked up by satellites. They put trackers in its hooves, and they suggest even putting other measures in there only for Steve Trevor to shoot them down and say, no, Abner Smith would have thought of this. He's far too clever to be caught that way. So they don't even try.
So let's not even try.
Let's not even give it a shot. Let's do this other thing. that's their plan. That's their plan is for all this to work. But Abner has taken certain steps here, Nick. He's set up an abandoned old West town where where the borough knows to walk into this particular saloon that has a secret hidden lair. And in this secret hidden lair, the donkey will be washed, which will remove the ultraviolet coating. And then all of these colored rays will descend upon the donkey, which will disable the trackers in its hooves. And Steve Trevor and Bob, as they're sitting in the vehicle, are just flabbergasted by this. Well, I shouldn't say that. Bob is flabbergasted. Steve Trevor is altogether nonplussed.
Yes. As he is with those things.
It's almost as if he knew that Abner Smith would know how to remove these trackers.
And all the while, Diana is, of course, tracking the burrow herself, still hoping to get the books back without having to pay the ransom.
Yes. And so...
And she winds up at some point in the underground thing with the burrow, and then there's multicolored mud, and I admit, I had no idea what
was
happening.
I didn't know what that multicolored mud was. I agree with you on that.
No.
Cement,
like,
I guess?
Green mud and red mud. But why was it colored? Why was it different colors? If it was just cement, I mean, what was the point?
Well, they had those different colored rays that fell down on the donkey. So maybe the different colored rays had an effect on the cement and caused it to change. I don't know.
It doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense, Greg.
Well, You might be asking yourself, Diana Prince, she's a secret agent. Does she ever wear the Wonder Woman costume? And the answer is kind of.
The answer is no, not the classic Wonder Woman costume.
She wears instead a jumpsuit that looks like the Wonder Woman costume. Stars and stripes.
It has the same like color pattern. I don't know that it necessarily looks like the Wonder Woman costume.
Yeah, she's got a belt, you know. She's got the stars on the sleeves, the red middle part. The white trim, so you know, red, white, and blue, and all that, and that's kind of what she wears for the back half of the movie, really. But the other thing that she does along the way is she almost gets seduced, but George makes an attempt to seduce her, Nick. Even though his initial instinct is to kill her, Abner informs him, "No, do not kill her. We just need to delay her." And George says, "Yeah, we need to kill her." And he says, no,
he does say that.
And then they go out to dinner. They agree. Here's the thing. George calls her and she clearly knows who he is and what he is instantly. And she agrees to meet him for dinner in the lobby. And this is actually going to go into one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. And also one of the reasons I like this portrayal of Wonder Woman is as she's getting into the elevator to first go to her room, one of the androgynous thugs tries to jump her, and she just casually kicks him right in the chest and knocks him out of the elevator and just goes up to her room and smiles like nothing happened. I just love how nonchalant she is about every attempt on her life that we see in the movie. At one point, George sends a snake to her room, and the snake coils around her leg, and you think, oh my God, she's actually in danger for a moment, and then she picks up the phone and like handles it so casually and so cleverly and comes out of it looking just as graceful as always, and still goes downstairs and has her dinner with George.
Let me tell you this right now, Greg. If I ever get bitten by a snake and die, I want my family to sue Warner Brothers and Kathy Lee Crosby personally for wrongful death, because I'm going to try and pacify the snake with a bowl of milk.
Because
now
milk. Yep.
This has taught me that snakes love milk, and we'll just go drink the milk instead of biting me.
I want you to bring to my room a saucer and a carton of milk, and I want you to take your shoes off before you enter. Why was it so important, by the way, that he took his shoes off?
I don't know.
Just to be quiet,
I guess. To make it quiet and like less vibrations or something on the ground. I don't fucking know. Why does anything happen in this movie? I don't know.
Well, I will tell you what does happen is that George and Diana have dinner together, a romantic dinner, as they're sitting around trying to learn about each other. And this is actually, we talked about this a little bit off the air, Nick. One of the things I like the most about this movie, other than the guy that we haven't talked about yet, is the sort of verbal repartee that Diana has with some of these characters, particularly George and then Abner later in the movie. But the dialogue here I thought was really clever, because both of them are talking in code. They, in that they know who the other one is and why each of them is there, but they're not just coming out and saying it. They're not coming out and just being blatant about what they're here to talk about. They're kind of hinting around at it and jousting with each other, almost jockeying for position. And then at one point, George drops all pretense and he just says, "Make love to me." To which...
And she goes, why?
Which, you got to give it to it, Nick, might be the best line in the movie.
And then he starts explaining. He's like, "I just find you so attractive." Why? She's like, "No, I know why you would want to. Yeah, why would I want to?
Oh, she's really funny at times in this, with the way that she reacts to things. And she almost gets run over by a car and does this cool backflip up onto a canopy. She's just... Her way of kind of jousting with George throughout this movie is pretty compelling. But let's get to the most compelling part about this movie. The real star of this show is not Kathy Lee Crosby as Wonder Woman. The real star of this show is Abner Smith. Now, with a name like Abner Smith, you might picture somebody like a Rock Hudson, right?
Yeah.
Like a Cary Grant to be an Abner Smith. But
you might picture a white guy.
But who do they cast as Abner Smith here? And you got to give them this, Nick. This was the most brilliant casting move they could have made. Because the villain of this picture, the prime villain anyway, is none other than Ricardo Montalban. That's right, Khan himself. One of the most suave individuals who has ever walked God's green earth plays Abner Smith. And... this dude, from the minute he talks, is just cool AF, as the kids say. He's wearing this... all you see for the first part of the movie is he's wearing this all-white suit. And you just see him from behind. He's got his little cane with the gold handle on it. And it's just badass. It's just so cool. And then, somehow, Nick, once they finally do show his face, he manages to be even cooler. It's like Ricardo Montalban is in his own movie, is it not?
Yeah, he doesn't really care what anyone else is doing. Dismissing George all the time.
Yes.
Having good chemistry with Kathy Lee Crosby. Good stuff.
Yeah. So Ricardo Montalban, for those of you who don't know who he did play Khan in The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek movie. I believe he was on what was that 80s soap opera that he was in? He was on Fantasy Island.
Fantasy Island, I was about to say. Not really a soap opera.
I thought he was in a soap opera at one point later in his life.
You'd certainly know more than I would.
I sure certainly would. There's nothing wrong with soap operas, quite frankly.
By the way, are you heartbroken over Days of Our Lives or whatever?
I feel bad ending? For those people. That's some shitty stuff that's going on. Dynasty was the show that he was on, by the way. But
he was in both Escape from the Planet of the Apes and Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
He was. And basically, all you need to know about Ricardo Montalban is he was one of the coolest dudes of all time. Just exuded coolness. Like, when you look at him, you think of badass rich dudes in the 70s. Like, he's just awesome. And he's awesome here as Abner Smith, because Nick, I don't know that this movie deserves a character like Abner Smith. a character that is so nuanced that he is this global supervillain. Clearly, right? He's amassed his millions by stealing from the Louvre, by stealing from all of these high security places around the globe, and he's amassed this empire. He commands loyalty in his minions, except George, clearly. He's a powerful man, and a villainous man, but he has a clear moral code. He has a clear way of going about it. The way that I referred to him, Nick, when we talked the other day, is the gentleman villain, right? That classic, like, bad guy, but the bad guy that is going to be a gentleman about it. He's going to hold the door open for ladies. He's going to address people by their preferred name. He's going to try to solve his problems through any way other than violence. He actually abhors violence. He doesn't want anyone to get killed. He doesn't want anyone to get murdered along the way to get this done, if there's any way to avoid it. He admires Diana greatly. In fact, when they later in the movie, when they go to his hidden underground lair, which really adds to the Austin Powers elements here, doesn't it? They go to his underground lair, and as they're kind of talking back and forth, you know, there's this level of almost respect between both of them at times, where each of them is trying to outsmart the other, but also they're genuinely trying to reason with one another as well. And he always seems to be a step ahead of everyone else around him. George tries to betray him at one point, spoiler alert. And Abner just kind of casually gets rid of him, right? He knocks him out with knockout gas and gets him into the water. And poor George, he informs Abner, "Can't swim." And Abner says, "Really, George? Oh, that's too bad." And he canoes away. To which the audience says, "You know what? I kind of hope Abner gets away." Like. Was I alone in this, Nick? Was I alone in actively rooting for Abner Smith by the end of this movie?
Good God. Yes, I think you were. I'm sorry. I got distracted. I was looking up Ricardo Montalban, and I was scrolled to the bottom of his Wikipedia or his Google results. One of them is people also search for Hervé Villechaize, who was his little buddy on Fantasy Island. It's just a picture of him, and it made me laugh. Let's move on.
The plane, boss.
The plane. Oh God, I am full of it.
You are
tonight.
Full of something tonight. Anyway, he also, by the way, Ricardo Montalban also told us about the rich Corinthian leather at one point.
Yeah, I read that.
But yes, Ricardo Montalban as Abner Smith is the highlight of this film. I would say this movie is worth watching because of the nuanced Diana, but also because of Ricardo Montalban stealing every single – he doesn't steal every scene. He steals this entire movie. He just completely steals it. He is just amazingly cool. I wanted him to escape at the end. That's one of the things – I can't believe that this didn't get picked up for a show, because – after seeing this, I wanted to see more of Abner and Diana jousting back and forth. He's taken away in handcuffs to jail, but it's clear that he could pop up again in the future.
And we never see George's body.
Yes, George can go fornicate with himself as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, but you know, the world needs heels, Greg.
That's true. The world does need – well, Abner is a heel.
Imagine that, a heel who actually wants to get booed.
I know what you're doing here. You're trying to draw a correlation between George Calvin and King Baron Corbin, and I won't have it. You need to be the little plebeian that you are, and stop trying to make negative comparisons to the great King Corbin. Now, are you done? Do you have it out of your system?
I'm just making a point, Greg.
Yeah. Well, my point is that Abner Smith is awesome. George is technically could still be alive. I guess he could have learned how to swim somehow. And Abner, I want to see him joust with Diana some more, have these great conversations over coffee, over wine, over fine champagne, things of that nature.
He doesn't get fine champagne in jail.
He's Abner Smith. He gets what he wants. He gets what he wants. If he tells the guy watching him, the officer that walks by his bars,
the jailer,
he says, "Excuse me, I would like the finest of the bubbly." Do you not think that the jailer would bring him a little bit of the bubbly?
I don't think he would.
Well, you're full of shit. This really could have established. Think about what this show could have done, Nick.
Listen. You're sitting here advocating for Abner Smith, the villain, a man who tried to sell the information of 39 U.S. intelligence agency officers. But I say one thing in defense of Mr. Potter, and all he ever did was fuck with that whiny ass George Bailey, and I'm the worst person that ever lived. I don't want to hear
it. Mr. Potter actively ruined people's lives. Whose lives did Abner Smith ruin? He had no intention of selling this information. He knew that they would cave to his commands.
George's for one. Those military policemen who were murdered for another.
Well, that was George's doing, first of all. Second of all, George deserved it.
Don't tell me like he didn't know how George was going to handle it. He gave the order, Greg. He gave the order.
He ordered the code red?
He ordered the code red. That's right.
You're not allowed to like that movie, Nick, because it's got Mr. 5-3 in it.
Hey, whoa. It's a drama, not an action film.
Oh, so it's okay for him to do dramas.
Yep. I'm glad you're catching on.
Lord. So Ricardo Montalban's Abner Smith.
He's better in them.
Let's talk more about him, Nick. What do you think about him?
He's good. He's good. I fear that anything I say is going to be received harshly because it's not. God, isn't Abner Smith the greatest thing that ever lived?
I mean,
as you like to
pretty well. He's pretty damn close. He's no King Corbin, but he's pretty close to the greatest thing that ever lived.
I am detecting that you like this movie a lot.
Well, here we go, Nick. Here's the bit of controversy here. Here's a little bit of a little bit of controversy. This ain't that bad. I'm going to go ahead and say it. This is not that bad.
It's okay.
It's. Are there things in this that are terrible? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. The
entire like donkey subplot is ridiculous,
but kind of funny.
But in a stupid like fun way.
Yeah,
yeah,
but a fun
like,
stupid.
Fine.
Yes. The bad stupid stuff is like the generic like U.S. intelligence agency and top secret books and. The attempts at trying to be a serious spy thriller at times fall short, but and the acting, oh God Almighty, the acting at times is just brutal.
Yes, the girl who plays Angela is awful. Like
she has
Angela.
Yeah, she's trying to play like a heel, like a good heel, but she doesn't pull it off. Andrew Prine as George is not very good, honestly. I don't know. You might disagree with me on that, Nick. You seem to be a little higher on George than I was.
Yeah, you're coming down on George a little too harshly.
But the two goons, my Lord, who are these people? Why do they look so unfortunate?
Oh, and why do they have one of the greatest death scenes ever, where they turn around,
George
is about to shoot him, and the guy goes, "Oh, George."
A great death scene. Why, George? For the money.
For the money.
Why else?
Now, see, it's all about the money.
Yeah, what if Vincent Kennedy McMahon, he was young then, what if he had played George? That would have been better.
What if this guy had played Vincent Kennedy McMahon?
It's all about the money, huh? What about the money? That was like a 20-minute segment. It was so beautiful. Anyway, yeah, so those guys those people are just horrible. However, there is plenty here that I liked. The dialogue I thought at times was very smart, very well written. At times it was almost shockingly well written, far beyond some of the other stuff I've seen from the era in terms of superhero shows. And you know, we watched that 70s. This was. Far better than that 70s Shazam show that we reviewed not long ago.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Totally.
Well, yeah. I think it also has a little bit of a different audience. Like that was so clearly like going
kids,
for the
yeah.
like fourth grade after school special kind of thing. And this is conceivably adults might possibly watch
yes.
this.
In the vein of like Bionic Woman or $6 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I think was a little after this, but so yes, to answer your question, Nick, I'm not, I wouldn't say that I'm sky high on this. I don't think this is not, you know, Arrow or
well, you've offered vocal, I mean, full-throated defenses of both the lead performances.
Yes.
So
I have. I think there was, and I will unabashedly say, while I've never really sat down and watched the Linda Carter Wonder Woman much, we'll have to do that in the future. However, I'm sure it was probably better than this. However, for this version, which is not like the traditional version of Wonder Woman that we know, it's not a classic Wonder Woman like we got with the Linda Carter show, I thought this was interesting. I would have watched this as a television show if I were around in 1974. I would have been interested to see what happened going forward with these characters, and particularly if they could have gotten Abner Smith and Diana to have a sort of Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling before those characters existed relationship. That could have been interesting. Really interesting. She has to go and visit Abner in jail occasionally, and then, of course, at the end of the season, Abner escapes, and he's the villain of season two. I mean, there's a lot to be mined there, I thought.
I thought it was all right. Like, it had a lot of really cheesy elements that, as you said, were very distinctly 70s. Yes. But, again, the only things in it that are just like, God, this is so bad I can't watch it, are pretty much just the Steve Trevor stuff. And
the Burrow.
The Burrow is hilarious. Yes, absolutely. Like, at one point, she's having like her big fight scene with Angela, and all of a sudden, here comes the donkey attached to a damn helicopter.
We left out the most amazing part of Abner's plan. After he's disabled the tracking mechanisms, the Burrow then leaves the lair and trots off into this cave in a mountain. And when it trots out of the cave, it's not just one, it's like five of the exact same Burrow that look exactly the same with saddlebags on them, and they all trot out. And this, of course, is designed to make it impossible to track.
That's right, but as we are later told, Diana knows that a Burrow's hooves are like a human's fingerprints. Each one is distinct, so she just follows the hoof prints
and gets all the way back up the mountain and has her big showdown with the forces of Abner. She and Abner share a drink together. They talk about their philosophies, and she double crosses him. He double crosses her. A lot of crossing going on. But yes, I at the very least,
a whole lot of crossing going on.
At the very least, we would have to say that this is not deserving of its reputation as some complete disaster. I liked it more than Nick did, clearly. But I don't think it's amazing. I'm not saying, hey, you're going to watch this and you're going to think, gosh, this is amazing. This is better than Linda Carter. This is better than anything, really. But all I'm saying is it's got two interesting performances, one really good performance from Ricardo Montalban. There could have been something here, maybe. Fascinating.
No, you want them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I offered my thoughts on it. What more do you want from me, Greg?
What I want from you, Nick, is I want you to engage our audience and tell them how they can contact us and let us know their thoughts on this matter.
Well, if you want to know, you want to talk with us about your thoughts on the 1974 Kathy Lee Crosby Wonder Woman made-for-TV movie, be sure to tweet us, first and foremost. That's the best way to get in touch with us. That's at JRsBBQ. And be sure to let us know your thoughts there. You can also, as a backup, try at NickDuke87 or at GPhillips8652. But again, at JRsBBQ is the preferred method. And then also, we have the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page that you can, I guess we could talk about it there if you want to. It'd be good, nice to talk about something there for once.
Indeed. And so
actually, it wouldn't be nice. Let me take that back. I don't really want to talk with anybody on Facebook. I feel obligated to say that.
We've had some good convo. Well, you haven't. We've had some good convos on there.
But yeah, exactly.
So anyway, yes, we'll be back. We're going to take a little break. In the meantime, you guys can go and check out Wonder Woman 1974 on DC Universe. See what you think about it. If you really hate it, try to wash it down with a little bit of the Linda Carter Wonder Woman or the Wonder Woman animated film, which are both on the service as well, I believe. So,
is the Gal Gadot film on there?
I'm not 100% sure.
Why isn't it? Why shouldn't it be?
I don't know. I can't answer that. It may be on the HBO thing for all I know.
That's true.
But
that thing doesn't exist yet.
No, I mean HBO Go.
Oh, HBO Go.
HBO Now.
I thought you were talking about the HBO Max is what we're waiting on.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes. A little bit of that A little bit of the Green Lantern there. Well, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with all your usual stuff, reading, watching the rundown, right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We hope you enjoyed halftime here at the show. And what we are going to do now is tell you about all of the exciting things going on at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. I'm going to start us off by telling you a little bit about what's going on over at the Pop feed. Ready? All right.
Yeah.
The Sarcastic Four are back with the latest episode of the Marvel Age podcast, where they continue their look at roughly one-third of the most significant of Marvel's output throughout the year 1972. You're a part of that crew, Nick?
I am.
Some might say you're the leader of that crew, but I don't think there was an election.
Oh, now, I wouldn't. I'm not leadership material. I'm just a good man who steps up when he's called upon.
You need to talk to your boy.
I don't have a boy yet. I need to talk to him.
Not yet, Nick.
No, there's still time for that.
There's still time to put another piece of bread in the oven or whatever this
expression. No. put another piece of bread in the oven. Almighty.
Anyway, you need a boy to run around there and keep things in line.
No, I don't need any more responsibility or stress in my life.
Oh, that'll cause you any stress. Your girls are good.
Oh my God, you know, you don't even know.
They're good when they're around me. Well, okay.
Says you. Says you.
All right. Anyway,
moving on.
Looking forward. Looking back.
Looking back.
Cowboy and John D'Amato look back at the recent MLB season and ahead to the newest NBA season. Weekly, the hard-traveling fanboys go on a long book hunt and venture into Elseworld with James Robinson's The Golden Age book. Weekly, DC4U takes a wild trip down memory lane with guest Greg Phillips. That's me.
That's
as they discuss,
that's you.
Jeff John's book, Green Lantern Rebirth. You know what that book is, Nick. You've read it?
Oh, yeah. I have. I was talking about this football game on the television.
Very, very good book. This week in the NFL hits weekly as well, with Roger and Johnny recapping the last set of games and previewing the upcoming weekend's batch. Not Charlie Batch, though. Siblings Kevin and Mary host the Brother-Sister Rewatch podcast. On episode 24, they bring you The Office Season 3, episodes 19 and 20. On the newest weekly Diamond Conversations, the fourth episode features a one-on-one chat with Executive Vice President and GM of the Fredericksburg Nationals, Nick Hall. The greatest sitcom of all time tournament kicks off on Monday, November 25th, beginning with the play-in round. There will be four matchups per day, so make sure to like our tournament page so you won't miss a single one until the last one, which unveils Seinfeld as the winner.
What's going on over in
the office as the runner up?
What's going on over at the wrestling feed, Nick?
Well, over at the wrestling feed, on the premiere episode of Body Pressure Luck, PTBN's first ever wrestling trivia game show, hosts JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan welcome Ryan Everett, Neil Trauma, and Logan Crosland to battle it out. If you think what it takes to be a main eventer on the show, reach out to us. And you could be on a future episode. Reach out to us. That's right, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we'll get you booked on that other show.
Yeah, you know, Nick, we are both experts at the low crossbody, actually.
Yes, that's right.
Get about one foot off the ground.
The latest episode of the Place to Be podcast, JT and Scott are joined by Peter Winson, digging into the fallout from the Royal Rumble by looking at Saturday night's main event from January 27th, 1990.
Ooh.
On part one of the main event, Nate and Scott preview AEW's Full Gear and Impact's Turning Point. Then Scott Criscolo, Nate Milton, and Tim Cable get together on the latest main event special AEW Full Gear reaction show to break down and give their analysis. On a new Wrestling War Zone, JT and Chad dive into Raw and Nitro from 2596. Row 1, Seat 1, number 28. That's confusing. Then host PTBN's own JT Rosero, chronicling his history as a wrestling fan and the founding and growth of Place to Be Nation. In our newest show, With This Ring, husband and wife Ryan and Cindy look at 5 matches and discuss where they place on Ryan's GWWE match list, as well as Cindy's personal list.
By the way,
on the latest
podcast has maybe my favorite name of any of the podcasts on any of our feed. I love that name. I just have to say that.
Oh, it's either that or you don't know Billy Jacket.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
You know, on the latest PTBN Extreme 3-Way Dance, JT, John, and Jenny continue their ECW adventure with the much anticipated Hostile Shitty Showdown. Subscribe to Jenny Position, the new home of geek, sassy, talk and pop, freak out, drive in, telling stories, telling tales out of school, and more. Don't forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes, bringing you articles on topics in the world of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including the SmackDown on Fox report, this week in the WWE, Jason's DVD deep dive, and Ben's unpopular opinion. Hey, that's what Ben Morris was talking about. Last week we said Ben's unpopular opinion is just Ben Morris's Twitter account. That's what it was.
Oh,
I've been trying to figure that out all day, and then I reminded when I read it. I forgot that Ben's unpopular opinion was even a thing that exists, but I digress.
It does.
But don't forget about veteran columns like every Wednesday we've got the most interesting and unexpectedly funny stories on the World Wide Web in Glenn's Weekly Walk. And for college football fans, Scott Criscolo and Logan Crosland have their weekly Campus Hot Takes, looking back at the previous week and looking ahead to the biggest matchups. Good God. And if you're doing online shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon, and it takes you right to Amazon and helps out PTBN with no cost to you other than the cost that you're paying for the goods from Amazon. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE PPV and TV Matchover project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your lists. Ballots are now open, and the ballot link is available on the Facebook group page.
Breathe, for God's sake, breathe. All right.
I think we need a few more shows to promote, Greg.
I agree. You know, I listen right now to Grillin' JR with Conrad Thompson. That's a good show. There's the Arn podcast that started. There's a lot of shows we can also promote. Yeah. Even outside.
All the Conrads are great. All the Conrads are great.
Good old Connie. What's he up to these days, I wonder? Other than podcasting, real estate.
Mortgaging.
Oh, good point. Good point. Well, that brings us to an end of that segment, and now we begin our new segment. It's our weekly look at the PN news and notes in the world of comics, a segment known in some portions of the globe as, Nick, The Rundown!
Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Oh my gosh, Nick, are you excited for The Rundown this week?
I suppose I am.
suppose we both are. Let's kick things off with our contractually obligated wrestling comics tie-in talk, shall we?
Yes, let's.
Well, none other than the jabroni-beaten, pie-eaten, trailblazing, eyebrow-raising, People's Champ The Rock finally has made official what has been rumored for many a moon now. And that is that aforementioned People's Champ The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, will be playing officially Black Adam in a movie to be released December 22nd, 2021. And
we are still assuming, and this is still the Black Adam standalone movie, right? Not a Shazam sequel?
Yes, that is my understanding, based on The Rock's post. To promote this, DC released an image drawn by Jim Lee that is representing The Rock as Black Adam as concept art, and it looks awesome. It's Jim Lee drawing The Rock. How can you go wrong? Looks awesome. Looks badass. And The Rock has a nice, beautiful post about this, about how important this role is to him for representation, to play a character like Black Adam, who's more of an anti-hero. Looks awesome. I can't wait, Nick. They're marrying one of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time to one of the great Jeff Johns reclamation projects of all time. This is sort of a marriage of both of our interests, right?
Oh, yeah, this sounds awesome. I mean, like, I still question how they're going to get an entire movie out of it, necessarily, and then have him, you would think, be the antagonist in a Shazam follow-up and actually want Shazam to win. I think that's going to be part of the problem. Yeah. I think Jennifer Smith will be the only person alive pulling for Shazam to defeat Black Adam in that situation, but it's a good problem to have, and let's hope they can continue their forward momentum as they have built over their last few cinematic offerings.
Yes, certainly going to be interesting to see the story of the film. It'll probably be an origin, I would imagine. Maybe the film takes place in ancient Egypt. And so we're going to...
Khandaq, actually. Khandaq, sorry. Thank you.
Yes, ancient Egypt. Well, Khandaq, Egypt, pretty similar. And let's move on to our next bit of DC media coverage, shall we, Nick? Because we also got our first teaser trailer. And it is just a teaser for Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is coming up here in less than a month, Nick. Can you believe it?
Still so exciting. Got a first look at Brandon Routh moving as Kingdom Come Superman. Yep. That was good. Got a shot of some heroes running around together. That was good. Man, the anticipation level just continues to grow for this.
Especially, Nick, and I know this is not the appropriate segment to discuss this, but especially with the level of quality that particularly the two lead shows are taking into this event with Flash and Arrow. This has got a lot of momentum riding into it. It's not just a situation where the event itself is exciting, because it is, but it's also the momentum leading into this event and how this event is shaping the shows around it, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
All right. We also got news that officially Titans has been renewed for season 3 on the DC Universe app. I am still stuck. I've only seen the first 2 episodes of the new season, but as I mentioned on the show a couple weeks ago, I thought episode 2 of season 2 was a huge step up in quality. Very excited to see where this show goes from here. This also means that we will continue to see some fan favorite concepts from the comic books and from the classic Marv Wolfman and George Perez comics run come into the show in all likelihood. So that should be fun to watch and could lead us to some particularly interesting live action comics adaptations we've never gotten. Like, I could totally see them doing if not a direct adaptation of A Death in the Family, I could totally see them dealing with the fallout of what happens in A Death in the Family on this show.
Yeah, because you would think that there won't be enough Batman in any Titan season to really do full on Death in the Family, but like you said, lots of different directions they could take it. I haven't seen any of season 2 yet, but I'm glad that it's continuing to be successful and that it's moving forward. I know a lot of people are big fans, and there was some concern over the DC Universe, the future of the DC Universe app after, you know, Swamp Thing was canceled and HBO Max has been announced, but seemingly we're going to continue to get DC Universe stuff for now. So let's enjoy it while we have it.
Yes, indeedy, doddly do. Well, moving over to the
marvelous competition, sort of, or rather two guys that are tied to the marvelous competition. Joe and Anthony Russo, the acclaimed directors, of course, of Avengers Endgame, Avengers Infinity War, Captain America Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War, basically the guys that have shaped the latter part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they're going back into the comic book movie business for a different project. They are producing a documentary series based on Reed Tucker's nonfiction book, Slugfest, inside the epic 50-year battle between Marvel and DC. And Nick, this is going to be on the streaming service Quibi.
What is a Quibi?
I believe that it is a tiny, tiny alien creature from the original Star Trek series.
Fair enough, because I don't know what it is.
I don't know that either. I don't know what Quibi is. I don't know how to access Quibi. I couldn't tell you. I do understand that you have a little bit of a familiarity with this project, though, Nick. Why don't you tell the listeners about this project?
It's based off a book called Slugfest that, you know, basically lays out the history of the Marvel versus DC rivalry. And it's pretty good, actually, taking a look at, you know, the kind of corporate machinations between the two, the maneuverings and whatnot. Kind of a high level, but I'm assuming that with the Russos involved, you can dig a little bit deeper if they so choose to. I don't know what the format of this is going to be at all. But yeah, good stuff.
I have a question. It seems like the art used in this is from the illustrious JLA Avengers book. And at some point, I want to read that book, and we should review it on the show. The issue is, I don't know how the rights work on that, because I don't believe that it's been reprinted anytime recently. And I'm fairly certain, I haven't looked on DC Universe, but I'm fairly certain it's not on Marvel Unlimited. I'm assuming it's also not on DC Universe. How does one even, other than buying just a used copy of it, I mean, how do you figure situations like this will work corporately for crossover comics with regards to all these streaming services? It's interesting to me.
Well, I mean, it is interesting, but there have been relatively few of them, at least in terms of the, you know, mainstream big two. There have been some, but there haven't really been that many.
Yeah, you know, you got your Marvel versus DC from 96. You've got your Amalgam, of course, which we will get into at another time. But then you've got, you know, in the 70s, early 80s, they had some pretty cool crossovers. Superman and the Incredible Hulk, or Batman and the Incredible Hulk, Superman, Spider-Man. I think there was a Teen Titans X-Men one that I would love to read that I've never been able to find.
Yes, there was.
It would just be cool to read all these, and unfortunately, I'm not sure that the streaming services are going to be able to do that based on weird legal wrangling. But anyway, that's really off topic. That's the end of the rundown, folks. That's all we got this week for you. So that means, with the rundown out of the way, Nick, that all that leaves time for is, well, a little segment that is bringing back its original titling this week, believe it or not.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a little segment known to people in New Zealand anyway, and people stateside, as Reading and Watching. Nick, what you been reading?
Oh, nothing.
Well, I finished reading Doomsday Clock number 11 by Jeff Johns and Gary Frank. And frankly, I enjoyed the hell out of it, as I have this entire series to this point. I will say that it's not the best issue in the series. I don't think it was going to be hard to follow up issue 10. I thought issue 10 was probably the best issue in the entire series to this point. Issue 11 is kind of set up for what's going to come in the finale. Laying a lot of cards on the table, Ozymandias reveals a lot more of his scheme in this one than we saw in some of the previous issues. And so that's interesting to keep track of. But the art continues to be blow-away amazing. The characterizations continue to be amazing. And the world-building continues to be amazing. This feels like a DC universe that is genuinely on the verge of becoming what the Watchmen world was on the verge of becoming in 1984 in the story of the original Watchmen. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing what's going on. 1985, sorry. So it's pretty amazing what's going on here to me. The characters are all unique and interesting. And I'm curious how it's all going to wrap up, because they drop a lot of hints here, a lot of outright sayings about the nature of space-time in DC, the nature of the multiverse, how everything has been rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, and the potential to get back what was once lost. And ultimately, as we've talked about on the show before, Nick, what, if any, will be the actual ramifications of this event? So we'll see. Regardless of if it has ramifications or not, it's been a hell of a story to this point, and I've enjoyed it being the last sort of monthly comic monthly, yeah, right? The last quad monthly book that is on my pull list. So I'm gonna see it through to the end and see where the DC universe is left in its wake.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to catching up at some point as well. I don't know when that will be, but hopefully at some point.
Well, that brings us to watching. And same story as usual, Nick. I'm behind on everything except Flash and Arrow. I'm up to date on those, so I'm going to let you take lead at first and tell us a little bit about what's going on in the worlds of Batwoman and Supergirl.
So Batwoman, I believe the most recent episode was actually the Alice backstory episode. Ooh. Which was pretty good. Or starting to delve into it. We don't really get a full picture. We kind of get an idea of where she was and what she was doing, but the entire, there's still a little bit of intrigue there. We have the basic outline of it, and we find out that, you know, Jacob Kane looked a little bit harder for his daughter than we had been led to believe. And that there, you know, there's still some things left to be revealed there. Supergirl, we got a reveal that I absolutely hated, involving the character of William Day, who I want to go away and die. This show cannot do a good Catco storyline to save its life. I mean, every season, the Catco stuff is always a albatross around the neck of what is, generally speaking, pretty good Supergirl-related mm-hmm. stuff. But whenever it tries to focus on serious journalism storylines, yep. it just
and
falls
it's always
apart.
Been that way.
And I'm ready for it to go away.
What if Kara just stopped being a reporter?
Well, no, she can't do that, Greg. She's the best reporter.
I see. Well,
she's more human than anyone else.
Of all the reporters I've known in all my day, she was the most human.
Human.
Which anyone will tell you, if they've worked in the newspaper long enough, the best reporters aren't human at all. They have no feelings left after years of working in the business. In any event, the Arrowverse, let's get into that, and let's start out with The Flash, which continued our trek towards crisis, really. Barry knows that he's going to be wiped out of existence, so he decides to take Iris on a whirlwind getaway, a romantic getaway for one day only that will be a tour of the world, because he is the fastest man alive. And in doing so, he leaves Cisco in charge, sort of a test run to see how Cisco handles things, since he's been nominated to take over the team once Barry is vaporized in the crisis. And unfortunately for our dear pal Cisco, turns out that he gets bad news. He gets a visit from his old pal Breacher, played by the great Danny Trejo. And Danny Trejo informs him that his daughter and Cisco's ex-girlfriend has been killed, has been murdered. And we find out that the culprit is a villain named Echo, who has a very close tie to Cisco. And a lot of the episode, most of the episode, in fact, is dealing with the fallout of Cisco's grief, Cisco's guilt, and how Cisco problem solves this whole situation, while also dealing with his relationship with Camille, his girlfriend that he got at the end of last season, and their sort of growing relationship with one another and her growing characterization on the show. Meanwhile, we also have the new Wells, Harrison Nash Wells, who is trying to break into an underground tunnel to find the monitor, not the anti-monitor yet, the monitor. And Joe West tracks him down there and tries to find out what his deal is. They get into a little altercation, and they end up getting trapped down there. And that leads to a lot of the episode's humor, actually, is how Joe and Nash interact with one another. They have some really great conversations down there with that lead to a variety of different directions. Good scenes with two great actors, Tom Cavanaugh and the guy that plays Joe West. He's excellent, as everybody knows. And so, yeah, I thought this was another really strong episode. As I told you off air, Nick, anytime the Flash focuses on Cisco, I find myself enjoying it. And it's very rare that we get a Cisco episode. So I thought this was, in fact, I can't remember many at all from last season, but this was a great Cisco episode. And I enjoyed, I really enjoy Camille. I think she's a good character. I actually like his dynamic with her more than I liked his dynamic with Breacher when they were together. So I really like Camille. I really like Cisco. The Nash stuff was really good. I already like this new Wells. Like, there's really never been a Wells that I haven't liked. And
no, all the Wells have been really good.
This is another. So yeah, strong episode, yeah. I thought.
Do you what are your thoughts on the complaints from some fans that Breacher was essentially fridged?
Permission to speak freely?
Yes, absolutely. That is, it's our show, is it not?
I don't care. I can understand the argument to a degree, because
I mean, really, she's only killed off to have an impact.
Yes,
on Cisco.
And she's killed off screen. However,
I think we get one flashback sequence that actually shows it, but I don't even know if it was the actress that.
No, I'm pretty sure it was, because they would have had to pay her to come there and essentially get killed in one scene and then go. So, I don't have a problem. They probably couldn't get the actress. They thought it was a story worth telling to explore Cisco's grief, and I don't know. I don't think she had that compelling of a character that it was. It's just my take on it. I would have felt the same way if it was Caitlin and her, a boyfriend that she had in the past. You know, as we'll talk. You know, the villain, I suppose.
What was that character's name? Was it Breacher?
Breacher was the dead. Danny Trejo. Yeah. Gypsy, that's her name. Gypsy, yes. And she does have comic book ties, so I can kind of understand that, but like, it just didn't bother me that much. I was compelled by Cisco, and I was compelled by Camille and you know, the new dynamic they've set up. And the same way that if they, you know, if I'm trying to think of an example on one of the other shows of a love interest. Quite honestly, if they killed off Kate Kane's love interest on Batwoman, I wouldn't shed a tear. I wouldn't think twice about it.
Are you talking about Sophie?
Yeah. Or Sophie. Yeah, Sophie or the bartender that she met in the last episode that I watched.
Well, that relationship was not long for the earth. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. So yeah, it wouldn't hurt me at all if they killed off Sophie. And it's nothing to do with gender roles. It's just to do with what serves the story that they're trying to tell at this moment. Quite the same way I feel about Ronnie Raymond. We didn't get to know Ronnie Raymond very long on the show, and he got killed off. It didn't bother me, because the compelling character there was Caitlin. So, in any event, no, I thought it was a good episode. What did you think?
I liked it. Yeah. While it was a good episode, I think the show has had so much momentum building towards Crisis, though, with Barry, that this kind of felt like a. I think I would have appreciated this episode more in like the back half of the season than I do now, because I really want everything to be barreling towards Crisis, and this felt like a not necessarily a misstep, but just kind of a brief pause in that momentum.
One,
you know,
one
so
mistake,
still a good episode, but like not what I necessarily was.
One thing for. I would criticize them for is I thought it was a little bit of a cop out that the cliffhanger in the last episode was. Nash is about to break into this tunnel that he claims is where the monitor is, and in this episode he never breaks into that tunnel, and they tease it for the next episode after that. I feel like that's a little bit of a bait and switch kind of thing, and so I don't like that. I think that's a complaint that I had about it, and also, you know, clearly you want Barry on an episode of The Flash, and we didn't really get him here much, but I was willing to take the L on that one because of the value of a Cisco episode. And
we got to see Caitlin, not Killer Frost, but Caitlin again, pop up briefly to deal with our Venom-like enemy for the front half of the season. So that
Bloodwork, yes.
Say what?
I said Bloodwork. Bloodwork,
yes. Well, let's go over to Arrow. And Arrow continues its final season with another part of the Hard Traveling Heroes arc as Oliver and the team have to come face to face with future Team Arrow. Mia Smoke, William, and Connor Hawk. They all pop up somehow through the intervention of the Monitor in the present day. And to say that they are stunned would be an understatement. This episode is dealing with the fallout of these relationships. They all are shocked to see one another. They don't know how this has happened. Future Team Arrow doesn't want to tell current Team Arrow about how bad the future is, about the fact that Renee's daughter has been killed by Diggle's son, who is now Deathstroke. They hide all this information from them, and it kind of gets uncovered as the show progresses, and a lot of emotional turmoil in this one. We also get the arrival in Star City at the same time of a new Deathstroke, who is Grant Wilson, the other Slade Wilson son. We have seen him in the past in sort of futuristic episodes of Legends of Tomorrow and Arrow. But Grant shows up here to establish the Deathstroke gang, and we get to see them play a big part in this episode. And in the process, we see Oliver reconnect very easily with his son William from the future, but unfortunately connecting with the daughter he's never known proves to be much harder, as he and Mia have a pretty significant conflict with one another related to the fact that he never got to see her grow up, and she resents him for that. And I don't know if you'd agree with this, Nick, as great as all that stuff was, I thought the most compelling part of this episode was Diggle and Connor and their relationship.
Yeah, I was about to say, between Diggle and Connor and Oliver and his kids, like, I honestly would have been fine if there had been no physical adversary.
I didn't need
in
the
this
Deathstroke
episode.
Subplot. I completely agree.
Like, it was fine, but it wasn't that good, let's be honest. And every time it popped up to do anything, I was like, can we just get through this to get back to, like, the interesting dynamic of
this
episode?
It's a rare situation where you will ever hear me of all people, Nick, you've known me for so many years now, saying we didn't really need an action scene.
No. It should have, like, legitimately, the episode should have been all dialogue, essentially,
because,
and been fine.
And that's because the characters are compelling. We're invested in the characters, and the acting in this episode was very, very strong. I thought,
shout out to the guy playing adult William for the coming out scene.
Oh, dude,
that was
so good.
He and Stephen Amell both, I mean, killed
that
it. That
scene was so powerful, so good, and Mia was good as well. And then Connor and Diggle, they freaking killed it with their scene. That scene where Diggle has first found out that, you know, what the truth is about how JJ becomes Deathstroke, and he finds out that Connor's been lying to him about it, and Connor is just, he's falling apart trying to get his dad to forgive him, to give him his approval, to give him something, some kind of word. You can tell he's just waiting on something. He's like, Dad, I'm sorry, I don't know what I was thinking, I just didn't know how to approach it. He's throwing this out there, and he's clearly fishing for some kind of sign of hope. And we who know John Diggle after all these years, we know that he's going to say the right thing here, right? He's going to say the uplifting thing, and instead he says, what the hell do you want me to say? And he says son, or he says dad, almost like this dismissive, like, you know, you call me dad and my real, you tell me what about my real son, and you just tore my world apart like this. And he walks off, and it is a weakness in Diggle that we've never really seen before. We've only rarely seen. And we understand the reasons for that based on his own history with his brother. And to see that scene where those two have that father-son come-to-Jesus meeting with each other at the end of the episode, man, it was really good stuff. And
Kudos to the writers for coming up with this dynamic and this twist, and it kind of makes the futuristic stuff make a little bit more sense in the context of the show now, because it was all to set up these complicated character dynamics.
And is the future that we've seen set in stone, or are these actions themselves altering the future?
And I believe they are. I think that's exactly what we get hinted at here with the Renee subplot, because Renee finds out that his daughter is going to get murdered, which is heavy stuff. And by the end of the episode, he is committed that he's not going to allow that to happen. And the way that he's not going to allow that to happen is he's going to make the right moves instead of the wrong moves to prevent that future from happening. So I absolutely think that the future that we've seen is not going to come to pass. And by the way, that's a good thing, because as much as I've enjoyed future Team Arrow the whole time we've seen them, the only thing that left me unnerved about it is and this is the comic book fan in me, where the heroes are always right and the heroes always save the day. I'm not really comfortable with the concept that all of the work that Oliver has done for all these seasons was for nothing. That Star City turns into chaos when he's gone, and it actually ends up worse than it was before he came back. Same way I feel about depictions of Gotham City being a cesspool in the future, because it makes Bruce Wayne's sacrifice ultimately mean nothing. So I like the fact that they have a chance to change that. And I had some faith that would eventually be the direction they'd go in, and I'm glad to see it seemingly, anyway, happening.
Yep. Yeah, good stuff.
All right, well, let's rank them, Nick. I only had two to watch this week. I thought Arrow was just slightly better than The Flash was, but both good. How would you rank them this week?
Yeah, I would go Arrow, I'd go Batwoman, Flash, and then Supergirl.
Very good, Mr. Lau. Well, with all that being said, I guess it's that time again to look down at the...
Oh,
what's this?
Oh, God.
What's this coming back across the ticker here? Gary Danielson still employed by CBS Sports. No, that's not it. That's not what we're looking for. What's this one? Yes. Ho-Ho Loon's biographical information still located on the award-winning WWE Network.
Yes.
Fantastic. I don't know who keeps sending us these reports, but by God, thank you. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, let me look at the timepiece over here. I can't help but look at my Rolex watch, Nick, that I have bought myself recently. And it's telling me that it's almost time for the Wrestling Minute. Gosh, Nick, the world of wrestling, nothing really happened this past week, right?
Well, we had the AEW Full Gear.
Oh, did we?
We did. I have not seen the pay-per-view, so I can't comment too much either.
I wanted to see the pay-per-view. Quality... aspect
right.
of the show. I wanted to watch it. I had a long ass day on Saturday. A lot of things happened on Saturday, and I wasn't in the mood to watch an AEW show Saturday night, but I will watch it at some point, or at least I will watch the main matches, Cody and Jericho, etc.
Yeah.
Seemed like a fun show. People seemed to enjoy it. And nothing else happened of note in the wrestling world, I don't think.
No. Followed up with weekly television, Raw and AEW and NXT. Yep. Raw was not very good in my estimation. AEW and NXT were pretty good shows.
Yes, I saw only a little bit last night of NXT before I fell asleep, but I did see the Cruiserweight title match, which I thought was really good. Leo Rush versus Angel Garza. And that's the first time I think that I've really seen him in action. Maybe I've seen him once before, but he was good. He lived up to the hype, and Leo is very good. And I'm glad he's getting to do his thing now. I was kind of teeing you up because your boy is back, at least in the ancillary world of wrestling. Something we've talked about on the show before, whether it would happen or not, and what would be the case when it did happen. But Tuesday night on the WWE Backstage show on Fox Sports 1, it comes on very late at night, by the way. I think it comes on at 11 o'clock Eastern, if I'm not mistaken. And at the very end of the episode, that classic tune from Living Color Cult of Personality starts playing, and out comes CM Punk stepping into a pro wrestling ring officially for the first time since 2014. So, Nick, you are the CM Punk aficionado. I'm a fan of his as well from his wrestling work, but he was one of your favorites, right? So
yes, that's accurate.
What are your thoughts right now? What were your thoughts when you heard this happen? And what do you think it means long term?
Again, to use the same kind of language I used back when he did the StarCast interview a couple months ago, I think at the very least it signifies an increasing interest in at least being involved with wrestling. Because for the longest time, you know, especially right after he left the company and then when he was doing his UFC stint, he didn't want to talk about wrestling. He wanted to keep the focus on whatever he was working on at that point, whether it be comics or UFC or acting or what have you. And now, in recent months, over the last year really, he has become increasingly more and more open to discussing pro wrestling. He had the incident at the indie show where he allegedly came out under a hood and hit somebody with a go to sleep. Now, I don't know if it was a hood from Watts or not, but that's a different discussion for a different day. The point being, he is willing to be involved with pro wrestling, and that's a big deal. He's also a guy who's been very transparent, I would say, in interviews. He has said, I would absolutely go back one day. It would just take a big bag, you know, a lot of money. And WWE is in a position right now because of the nature of this, not even really a war, but they feel like they're at war. They are throwing out money that doesn't really make a whole hell of a lot of sense. But they also have a $1 billion TV deal from Fox, so they can throw out money now.
That's true.
So you combine the money with his increased willingness to be around and be involved. It's just a matter of time, right? Like, he's going to do something on a actual WWE produced program, and I would imagine it leads. I would think he's probably wrestling at WrestleMania.
I was about to say, do you think we see him in April?
I mean, yeah, because you got 6 months between now and then, or 5 months. You got plenty of time.
I think so too. I think he will have a match at WrestleMania. Maybe I'm crazy for. Maybe we're crazy for that. Maybe we're getting too ahead of ourselves. But I just do. I think he'll see a talent in doing this show that he really wants to work with, that interests him.
Even though, from a story perspective, Triple H is the natural story here, right?
Yeah, that would from a pure storytelling standpoint, that would be the one. I don't know if that even...
Or Seth Rollins, or a newly heel Seth Rollins.
But I don't know if the Triple H match would even interest Punk. I don't know. Maybe it would.
But if the money interests him, that's all that matters. Yes. He said that.
And it would also require Triple H to go heel again, which, in all likelihood, unless they present Punk as a heel, obviously, but...
That would be the stupidest thing that could possibly.
Now Rollins is very compelling. I think there's we spitballed a bear with us folks, we're nerds. We spitballed a fantasy booking idea of a heel Rollins against a face Punk that would work very well and be very simple to do where Rollins is just flabbergasted.
And you could even work Triple H into the story that way, like as Rollins has always been Triple H's boy,
and
you could, absolutely,
and you could tie that in. You could use that sort of generic, lame corporate speech that they give every wrestler that leaves the company about how they took their ball and went home, and they weren't there every single week for the fans, and you know all that, all the critiques that people make about Brock Lesnar, they could flip flop that and use it. And use it as a heel talking about a babyface, and probably pull it off really well.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm excited. It's just a fun time in wrestling, Nick. It's one even seeing the highlights from Wednesday night's shows between NXT and AEW. I was working late and didn't get a chance to watch both of them, but even seeing the highlights, they both looked so fun. It's a great time to be in wrestling. CM Punk is back in the fold. Joe is kind of hinting around about Punk. We got Daniel Bryan back in a world title match against Bray Wyatt, of all people. It's an interesting time in the wrestling business, and I for one am happy to be a fan.
Absolutely,
I guess that about wraps things up, right, Nick? We're done for the day.
I suppose it does, but we're going to end the show as we do each and every week now with a little musical exit from WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. And Jim, I don't know if you got an opportunity to catch the Country Music Awards that were on last night. Had the CMAs last night, and I know people at my workplace were buzzing over one live performance in particular. As I know, one of your favorites, old Reba McEntire, made an appearance. My Cheekbones, exactly, to do a little number of hers from back in the day. And so I thought, what better way to celebrate Reba's triumphant moment last night than you putting your own little spin on this number?
Well, thanks for the kind words, Conrad. I really do appreciate you you saying that.
Once again, I am not Conrad Thompson.
You look like Conrad Thompson. You sound like Conrad Thompson. Quite frankly, you even smell like Conrad Thompson. But you're telling me, you're trying to tell good old JR, oh, you're too old. You can't see anymore. I'm not Conrad Thompson. You are Conrad Thompson. I understand, Connie. Ha ha, get one over on old JR. That stuff might work on Eric. It might work on old Brucey. It might even work on Arn. It ain't going to work on me. Anyway, why don't you cue me up, get the tune going. I'm going to try to sing this damn song the best way I know how. And I'm going to try to put a little spin on things. You might hear these words. It might not sound like you've heard before. I've got to speak from the heart. I don't believe in a scripted promo. I believe that you need to speak from the heart. It needs to be real. It needs to be organic. And defiant. You know, I remember it all very well looking back. It was the summer that I turned 18. I was driving Leroy McGirt to his one-room, run-down shack on the outskirts of New Orleans, Watts Country. We didn't have any money for food or rent. In fact, I used to get paid in hot dogs. I don't know if you do that story. They would pay me a hot dog, and they'd say, would you like a Coke? That'll be 50 cents. To say the least, we were hard-pressed. And then Mama spent every last penny we had to buy me a dancing dress. Oh, I can hear, oh, ha-ha, JR's in a dress, so that's real cute. Listen, folks, you haven't lived my life. Mother washed and combed and curled my hair. She painted my eyes and lips. Then I stepped into a satin dress that had a split on the side, clean up to my hip. It was wet red velvet trim, and it fit me good. Standing back from the looking glass, there stood a woman where a half-grown kid had stood. And that's when Watts got a hold of me, and Watts said, here's your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Well, Cowboy dabbed a little bit of perfume on my neck, and then he kissed my cheek. And then I saw the tears welling up in his troubled eye as he started to speak. He looked at a pitiful shack, and then he looked at me and took a ragged breath. He said, JYD's runned off, and I'm real sick, and the baby's going to starve to death. Well, he handed me a heart-shaped locket, and it said, to thine own self be true. And I shivered as I watched a rope crawl across the toe of my high-heeled wrestling boot. It sounded like somebody else was talking, asking, Mama, what do I do? Well, Cowboy said, just be nice to the gentleman, Rossi. Just call the action that you see on your monitor, and they'll be nice to you. He said, here's your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Here is your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Well, McGirt, forgive me for what I do. But if you want out, well, it's up to you. Now, don't let me down. No, Cowboy's going to draw a lot of money and move you uptown. Musical interlude. Well, that was the last time that I saw Cowboy's ass. The next night, I left that rickety shack. The welfare people came. Crockett took the company. Watts went off and retired, and I ain't been back. But the wheels of fate had started to turn. And for me, there was no way out of Texas. And it wasn't very long till my ass knew exactly what Cowboy had been talking about. I knew right then what I had to do, and I made myself this solemn vow that I's going to be a lady someday, though I didn't know when or how. But I couldn't see spending the rest of my life with my head hung down in shame. You know how I might have been born just plain white trash, but Rossi wasn't my name. And I remember Cowboy said, here's your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. He says, here is your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Wasn't long after that that the benevolent Mr. McMahon took me in off the street. And 1 week later, I was pouring his tea in a five-room hotel suite. I charmed a king, Jerry Lawler, a congressman, Jesse the Body Ventura's assistant, and an occasional aristocrat. And then I got me an Atlanta, Georgia mansion and an elegant New York townhouse flat. And I ain't done bad. Made a decent amount of money, wouldn't you say? Fair amount of money. Now, in this world, there's a lot of self-righteous hypocrites, a lot of Richards on Twitter that call me bad. They criticize my ass for doing this or that. They criticize Cowboy for putting me in a wig and lipstick and turning me out, no matter how little we had. They don't understand that that's how the business works. But though I ain't had to worry about nothing for nigh on 15 by God years, well, I can still hear the desperation in my poor cowboy's voice ringing in my ears. He said, here's your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, Rossi, don't let me down. Lord, forgive my ass for what I did. But if you want out, what's up to you? Now, don't let me down. Cowboy's going to draw a lot of money and move you uptown. Well, yes, he did.
Hard traveling fanboys.